Welcome to episode 280 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. 2 years ago, Russia invaded Ukraine, touching off a nasty bout of energy insecurity. The consequences around the world were many, including spiking gas prices, both methane and gasoline. 6 months later, the United States passed the Inflation Reduction Act, a climate bill designed to fight global warming the right way, in my opinion, by speeding up the adoption of clean energy. Gernot Wagner is a climate economist at the Columbia Business School, and he recently wrote a piece called "The Ukraine War Blew Up the World's Energy Economy." But it was the subhead that really caught my attention. And the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act is surprisingly well-designed to deal with the fallout. He generously agreed to chat with me about his case in favor of the IRA. So welcome to Energy Talks, Werner.
Hi, Markham. Great to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you back. I read your pieces on a regular basis.
You're the one. Oh.
Well, I did subscribe to your newsletter.
So yes, okay. I said, you're the one.
I'm on the list. So let's talk about this. I think the basic facts behind Russia's invasion of Ukraine, how that affected in energy insecurity by creating shortages, particularly natural gas, and then Europe had to go out into the market and get LNG, and then that affected Asia. And next thing you know, we're all dealing with higher energy prices, and that to a large extent has settled down somewhat. But then, 6 months after that, the Inflation Reduction Act is introduced. How do those all work together?
So they do and they don't. And let me start with the don't version, right? So the Inflation Reduction Act has not and will not cut inflation in the, you know, on the time scale that we usually think about or worry about inflation. Or put differently, it's a horrible re-election strategy for President Biden, right? Because he will not be able to say the IRA will, you know, has cut inflation. So re-elect me. Inflation went down. But it went down for all the normal reasons that macroeconomists, you know, will drone on about, and I won't, largely because I'm not a macroeconomist. but, right, so, yeah, of course, right, Fed setting interest rates and all that sort of stuff matters a lot. But here's the case for why the IRA is perfectly named and why, in the long run, it is the only strategy to get off fossilflation. And I think fossilflation summarizes the argument, right? Because, you know, at the end of the day...
No explanation needed,
right? Like every decade or so, right? Oops, surprise. Somebody blows a fuse somewhere, right? Some despot or, you know, Putin blows a fuse, invades Ukraine, energy prices spike, fossil energy prices spike. And it's this interconnectedness of energy markets that is causing the problems. And no, energy independence, right, isn't the answer. Actually, here we go. The U.S., right, energy producer? No, we are not independent from what happens halfway across the world. So, yes, fossilflation is the problem. Getting off fossil fuels is the answer.
Okay, I want to run a hypothesis past you that my regular listeners will know all too well. And that is that, you know, 25 years ago, China decided that it was going to invest in clean energy technology manufacturing, solar panels, wind turbines, electric vehicles, batteries, all of it. Mm-hmm. And 25 years later, it is the 800-pound gorilla in the clean energy space. It has, I mean, this is common knowledge. I don't have to repeat it here. There are speeches by American politicians, and Gina Raimondo, the Secretary of Commerce, is the one I read the most, where she said, once the pandemic started in 2020, we suddenly realized, like a bolt from the blue, how dependent we were on Chinese supply chains. And that was not going to fly. And so we put in place the Infrastructure Act, the CHIPS Act, and then the Inflation Reduction Act, all of which is designed to build, to reshore manufacturing and for us to catch up to China and also to Europe in clean energy manufacturing and the adoption of clean energy. And so essentially, we now have a situation where China leads, the US and Europe are trying to catch up, and we now have a clean energy arms race. And the IRA is in part the response to that. Your response to my hypothesis?
It is not wrong. Let me start with that, which is always, you know.
Hey, anytime a professor tells me that I'm not wrong, I'm okay with that.
Well, you know, half-hearted compliment, right? So, okay, so of course, right? And frankly, okay, I'm not a Biden campaign spokesperson here, but yeah, Bidenomics, however you want to define it, is all of the above and then some. And when I say all of the above, right? It's basically the reindustrialization of previously industrialized areas of the United States, right? And, you know, no Soho lofts are going to disappear to get, manufacturers back into lower Manhattan. That's not what we're talking about. But yeah, kind of, sort of, the equivalent, you know, for Pittsburgh, for places where manufacturing has left over the past few decades for, by the way, reasons other than climate. Of course, right? Lots and lots of other factors that are at play here. What has that led to? That has led to all sorts of direct pain on the one hand, gain on the other, gains from trade. Of course, I'm enough of an economist to, you know, to have to point to that on a semi-regular basis and remind myself that I don't weave my own clothing, right? So yes, there are gains from trade. Of course there are. But there are also some massive implications, right? It's one thing for you and me, right, to say, you know, gains from trade, right? It's another for the person whose livelihood is at stake here. All put together, and maybe, you know, the best example might be the United Mine Workers of America supporting the Inflation Reduction Act. Basically means, yes, you know, not if, but when we get off coal, cool, that's good. But there are implications. There are, you know, the just transition isn't just a buzzword. It actually needs to happen. And yes, the IRA is instrumental in helping make it so.
I am a student of energy transitions. In fact, did my graduate work on the 100 years ago on from horses to tractors and combines.
So is the story correct? Like the 1896, the conference in Manhattan where they couldn't agree on what causes the horse manure and how to get rid of it?
You've been reading too much Tony Seba. I didn't pay attention to that. So don't know that story. But here's what I will tell you. Is the basic processes that drove the transition from animals and steam to the internal combustion engine and petroleum, the same functional processes are at work in this energy transition. We have new technologies that have become competitive in the marketplace, and they're pushing out old technologies, and we are restructuring markets, we are restructuring all sorts of things. And this is in the period of disruption, things get restructured. And I think that there are plenty of, there's China, there's Southeast Asian countries, there's India, who are looking at this and going, sixth industrial revolution, I like it. I want to be a player in this. This opportunity is not going to come along for a long time. And we're going to get the government behind it, and we're going to put money behind it. And we want a piece of this pie that previously we did not have. And so I think finally North America and Europe have woke up to the fact that there is major change going on. And if they want to maintain their economic hegemony, they need to do something. And here we are. This is what they're doing.
This is the infamous Economist magazine cover. From petrostate to electrostate.
Yes.
Right? And there, you know, there are two bits here, right? So one is, okay, yes, from petro to electro is fantastic. But of course, not everything will fall in place automatically, right? If, you know, in an undemocratic regime now stops selling its oil and needs to look for something else to do, doesn't mean that the replacement will be, you know, nirvana, right? It isn't, it won't, can't be necessarily automatically, right? It takes much, much more. Broadly speaking, I completely agree with you, of course. Now, here is one huge difference. Big Horse wasn't nearly as profitable as Big Oil, right? That is a massive, massive shift, right? Sort of the world's most profitable ever companies are those who in many ways tend to lose a lot in this process. Right. And, you know, not to go straight to the CEO of Exxon blaming the public for climate change. Right. But yeah, he has. He's done that right recently, a week ago or so, in this Forbes Fortune or so interview. Again, right. So the CEO of Big Horse did not. Also tried, presumably. Right. But, well, there isn't one. There isn't one person. There isn't one company. There aren't, you know, a handful of companies. You'd need to look much, much broader. And in many ways, that transition back then grew into a void, if you will, whereas the current one isn't. That's the big difference.
I would say that there was not a such a thing as Big Horse, but that doesn't mean that horse breeders and other people in the industry didn't have influence over governments and policy and so on. But sure. It the environment in the 1920s, let's say, is very different. The political structures and expectations from 100 years ago are so much different today. And so today, incumbents are able to exert a tremendous amount of influence on politicians and on policy and on regulations in order to protect themselves from the forces of disruption. And we see this in the U.S. all the time. We saw it with the coal companies and the gas companies opposing Obama's clean power plan. It's baked into the cake that this is part of one of the things that has to be overcome. And China, just as one example, doesn't have that problem. When the Chinese government sets its five-year plan, and then it sets the goals and allocates the capital, and then the provincial governments and the local governments look at that and go, okay, now I know what I have to do, and I'll go away and, you know, change my grid or, you know, install some solar panels, whatever the case might be. It's in some ways easier to respond to this transition in an authoritarian system than it is in a more market-based system.
Let me agree with you and I think add something that is important here, which is China's energy transition, if you will, is also growing into a void, right? And what I mean by that is, right, so when China adds, you know, hundreds of gigawatts, a billion watts of solar, it adds that in addition to the existing coal plants, the existing gas plants, and, you know, all the while building coal plants still to this date as well. Why? Because it is increasing its overall demand by so much, so fast that, yeah, this is the growing into a void, right? As opposed to what is happening, frankly, in, you know, Europe, the US, where solar, wind, and so on capacity is basically replacing, ought to replace, existing power capacity. That's a huge, huge difference. And it also, you know, it makes a difference. So from horse to cars, right? You know, we build highways, right? They didn't replace horses. I mean,
and
they replaced
service stations,
you know, a bunch
and
of horse farms
and refineries.
So
yeah,
exactly, right? So we build suburbs, right? Basically, we, like, cars enable suburbs, right? And that is a very different scenario than, in some sense, what we're looking at now, where we say, oh, wait a second, maybe it wasn't such a good idea to build all those single family homes in the middle of nowhere. Maybe there is something to, you know, walkable urban neighborhoods. Maybe there's something to the American Enterprise Institute's walkable neighborhoods program, right? I mean, that this is sort of the usual, right? Like when some from on the political right say, oh yeah, this is, you know, you leftist urbanites. No, it's AEI that has, you know, puts an emphasis on, wait, walkable neighborhoods, pro-family, good for the sort of things that we also stand for in other dimensions.
Yes, I can see your point. Pro-family and pro-small business and pro a whole bunch of stakeholders in the American economy. Now, one of the things that is fascinating to me is to watch the American states and their regulators and other stakeholders frantically re-engineer the power grids that make up the U.S. power grid in to accommodate variable renewable power.
Yep.
That, and I had Gerhard Schlage on here, who is the chief technology officer for Hitachi Energy. And he talked about how, look, I mean, you when you bring in variable electricity generation, you have to add a whole bunch of technologies from storage to AI to digital controls, power electronics. It's a different grid. And it seems like the Americans have made the decision at the top levels that that's the grid we want. We want a modernized, smart grid with all this fancy technology that will accommodate the lowest possible generation cost, which at this point is wind and solar. And is that a fair way to characterize that?
Yes. Let me also add, I'm old enough to remember that we've been talking about the smart grid for, you know, two decades at this point. And I don't think anyone, you know, to this date can define what that actually is. But it's clearly smarter than whatever the heck we have right now, right? I mean, that's clear. And yes, frankly, energy efficiency, demand response, right? The sort of things where I have my fancy German designed dishwasher sitting in my third floor walk up in lower Manhattan. And yeah, it does certain things very, very well. The smart start feature doesn't work because it can't talk to the grid on this side of the Atlantic, right? It just, you know, Con Edison is not smart enough yet to have a grid where it sends a signal to the dishwasher saying, okay, and now is when you turn yourself on because, you know, the sun is up and demand is down, or the wind is up and demand is down. That sort of thing, of course, takes investment in grid infrastructure, which in many ways by definition means government needs to step in and do something there, do something major. And again, right, back to the Inflation Reduction Act, yes, it does lots of those things. It's not going to solve it all, but clearly a right step in the right direction to get off fossil fuels overall. And that's the reason why it's beautifully named and why, frankly, we should cheer on the broad direction of this transition, no matter where you're from, right? No matter which energy company you work for, we know it's not if, it's when to march in this direction.
One of the things I appreciate about the IRA is the way in which it has embraced the future. They brought in people like Jigar Shah, the Department of Energy. Now he's running the loan program. I think they've got like $200 billion worth of loan applications. I mean, it's been wildly, but yep. He's an evangelist for innovations like virtual power plants. He's out talking about them all the time and out in the corporate world, you know, bringing along people, you know, maybe stakeholders who might be a little more conservative and a little more reluctant. And he's not alone. There are many people attached or not attached to the Biden administration who are out there evangelizing. And so there's a culture change. People are beginning to go, okay, I should have a power wall in my garage and solar panels on my roof, and I can do this and that and the other thing with them. And, you know, the culture around energy management, energy generation, how we approach this is changing in the U.S. in a way that it certainly is not in Canada. Like, we are laggards in Canada. I think that's pretty clear, not to the policymakers, but it's clear to me. So the IRA is more than just a climate bill. It's more than, certainly a whole lot more than an inflation reduction bill. And It seems like this is one of those nation building moments. It's like building the highway system after the, you know, during and after the war, that sort of thing. Like in Canada, we talk about building the Canadian National Railway in 1885, you know, as a nation building exercise. And this switch is like that. Would you agree or disagree?
I agree. I would say it's a positive tipping point. It's the sort of thing, right? You know, in the climate world, we, you know, way too many negative tipping points, and you know they're for real and they're bad and much worse than most people think and so on. And yeah, in this case, it's one of these positive socioeconomic tipping points that goes well beyond, frankly, the mere economic incentives. But yes, it's basically. It's what I would call this green growth mindset, right? Okay, so I teach at a business school, right? So growth mindset, right? Is the, you know, that's what TED Talks are made of, right? And LinkedIn postings and so on, right? Cool. Okay, this is the green growth mindset version. Or yes, it's, you know, frankly, it's this can-do spirit. It's the can-do attitude. And yeah, of course, right? It's the incentives, the economics, the policy that aligns with that attitude. And, you know, wishful thinking alone isn't going to make it so. And it's amazing to me to just look at some of these numbers. So at the IRA originally cost something like $400 billion, a bit less than $400 billion. That was the projection, Congressional Budget Office projection. Okay, a year later, 18 months later or so, by now we know the Congressional Budget Office is saying actually it's twice as expensive. Right, which depending on your political suasion, you can spin as, oh my God, right, this is bad. No, this is amazing. It's twice as popular. But more importantly, Goldman Sachs comes in and says, wait a second, guys, the CBO, bureaucrat, number crunchers, us financial types are going to project this, or we can project it too. And they come up with $1.2 trillion. Over 10 years in government spending, right? Three times as popular, and freeing something like $3 trillion in private money and, you know, $10 plus trillion in the next 30 years that are jump-started by the Inflation Reduction
Act. We're getting to close to the end of the interview, Werner. And one of the things that is crystal clear to me is the resurgence of industrial policy. Now, I'm old enough to remember when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980. But you know what preceded Ronald
I was born in 1980, so, you know, that's sort of old, God, old enough.
Thanks for making me feel old. But you know what preceded Ronald Reagan? A decade of debate about Milton Friedman.
Yep.
And a shift away from the sort of welfare state attitude of the 60s and 70s into, no, we want more market forces. We want less regulation, less government, less. And industrial policy was one of the things that suffered. Mm-hmm. It became unpopular. It wasn't cool anymore. And with China used industrial policy to build all of its clean energy manufacturing. The Europeans have used it. Now the Americans have re-embraced it. And people like Brian Deese, the former chairman of the advisory committee for the Biden administration, they talk explicitly, here's why we're doing this, what we hope to achieve. It's partly energy security, it's partly reshoring manufacturing, it's partly a whole bunch of things, but it's clearly back on the table. And if your government, if your policymakers do not have a particular specific approach to industrial strategy and industrial policy that flows out of it, then you are going to be a loser in the energy transition. My take.
Yes. Okay, this is Bidenomics, right? I mean, you know, that's what Bidenomics is defined as by those who designed Bidenomics, right? And yes, it's this, you know, long arc of history, if you will, story where you do see industrial policy come in together with this climate mandate, if you will, right? The sort of the clear push towards decarbonization does have something to do with fossilflation, does have a lot to do with it, is about insulating, insuring ourselves, creating more resilient supply chains that allow us to no longer be as dependent as we've been now for decades on right? What happens halfway across the world in energy exporting nations? That combination makes it a powerful, powerful instrument. But actually, I remember now, I don't want to advertise The Economist magazine too much here, but it's actually Brian Deese, National Security Advisor, and John Podesta, the three of them together, writing one of these by invitation pieces for The Economist, basically making those points, right? Talking about energy security, national security, industrial policy, decarbonization, right? Climate meets national security, meets energy security. That's a powerful combination. And having the economic incentives in place to make it so is, of course, well, again, that's the Inflation Reduction Act in a nutshell.
It is indeed. And one of the things that the Inflation Reduction Act is doing is mobilizing private capital. It's astonishing to me the amount of capital that has suddenly become available for hydrogen, for wind and solar farms, for investing in investor-owned utilities that need to upgrade their operations and their power grids, and all of the wonderful technologies that are just, I mean, they're transforming urban environments for sure and urban economies. And I look at Canada and just shake my head because it's not happening here. It's not to the same extent. We are basically tweaking our 100-year-old grids because we have 10 provinces and each one of them has their own grid. They rarely talk to each other. It's not much east-west trade. And it seems to me that if the 21st century economy is electric, and it is, that's the electricity is the foundation, it's as table stakes to play in this game, that those countries that transition to so that their grids are dominated by low cost, clean, reliable electricity already have a huge competitive advantage over countries that do not.
Amen.
On that note, Werner, thank you. It's always a pleasure, and continue writing those great op-eds. And we won't let 2 or 3 years go between interviews next time.
Sounds great. Great to be here.